Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity.
Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it.
As someone once said, it's always the right time to do the right thing. So this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Battles from Voices from the Battlefield. I'm so thinking battle. That's what we've been in for almost 11 months now since the MAGA folks took over our government, our democracy. And I always have to remind you all that this is still, we have a pathological liar in the White House. We have a 34-count felon in the White House who is destroying our democracy. And now we're getting closer to the fact that he was in complicity with a pedophile. And we'll get more of that when we've got a bunch of stuff that's already been released that's been revealing. But I just want to share an interesting conversation that I had on a Zoom meeting yesterday, and one of the questions was, what have you found interesting about the release of the Epstein files? And one of the persons said, it was interesting that people zero in on the grown women and think, okay, well, they can handle themselves. But the ones who are holding pictures of what they look like when they were first groomed as children, that hit home for this person. And I think that is the thing that I really would like for people to remember, because sometimes that gets lost in the sauce. Like, it might be years before your case comes to the light, even for yourself, because there's repressed memories and all of that. So sometimes people don't understand the gravity of it because you were a child. And oftentimes people don't understand the grooming process. That is an intentional process of manipulation psychologically so that you are then under the control of that pedophile. And we've seen this with priests. And you don't have to be a child. Grown people, men and women, can be vulnerable to being groomed just based on the state that they're in. So that was particularly struck me because I deal with children, I deal with youth development. And so, yes, that is important. I think the other things that we're finding out are probably not as surprising, like who were the powerful people in the room, who were the powerful people that were helping to be help to victimize those children. That's probably not as much a surprise, but I did zero in on that we need to remember that they were children, and to the knowledge of the files, almost 1,000 of them, and I'm pretty damn sure that it was more than that, because this happened over a period of time. This thing is huge. And I'm not going to get into the conspiracy theories of whether or not that monster is alive. I don't really care. I think that we do have to have justice for those victims. And so I'm hoping people will keep up with that case and remember that the victims were children at the time, vulnerable, and that abuse has followed them throughout their lives. And there are a couple of them who really couldn't deal with it anymore, who committed suicide. And so their voices, we need to make sure, continue to get heard. So, you know, there are positive things going on in the world, y'all. There's, you know, we got some victories here and there. For example, you know, the court said Texas couldn't use that map. You know, this is such a time for this country, because we are actually internally at each other's throats, and for good reason. I mean, we're not going to just roll over when we see our democracy being destroyed bit by bit, piece by piece. And for me and other folks, I think the metaphor of the destruction of the East Wing was really enough, because it was a metaphor. This man is tearing down and putting up fake stuff for his own edification. And so I do think that helped people to get out for that November 4th election, where we did some sweeps and swoops. So some of that was very positive and put us in positions where we actually can start the rebuilding of not only taking over or taking back our democracy, but there is a lot of disillusion with the Democratic Party. And so so some of them that stood up to fight, they got acclamation about what they were doing, like the Newsoms of the world, Gavin Newsoms of the world. So, I mean, there was record turnout in some places. What's going to happen in New York City with the new mayor? I am excited about watching what unfolds. So we still are staying woke, y'all. Don't be bashful about calling yourself woke. I'm going to stay woke, and I'm going to stay the angry Black woman, because that's what fuels me to fight for justice. So whatever turns you on, that's what turns me on. Looking up what's going on and say, that can't happen. Not under my watch. So, yeah. But we have two guests here that I'm excited to have conversations about, because I think this particular project really slipped by. It's almost like a ship silently going through the night, and I don't know if people understood the power of what happened. We have here today James McAnally with Counterpunch. Well, both Melissa and Saunders are with Counterpunch, but Melissa also has her own organization, which is called Black Arc, ARC, not ART, but it's all related. And, you know, Counterpunch is a group that basically looks to reimagining art in public spaces and public life, which is really different. Because when I talk to people who are artists, visually or otherwise, from St. Louis or beyond, I talk about what life would be like if we didn't have art. Mm-hmm. And it would be very dull. It would be very, very dull. So I always appreciate what you all are doing. And when you talk about reimagining, that gets me really excited. So James and Melissa are here, but we really are going to talk about the reclamation of the Sugarloaf Mound, which is the Osage Nation's land that was stolen, and that's what's left of it. Unfortunately, we're going to hear something about that. But how I got connected to James is because I was in Potawatomi country in around Kalamazoo, and we have a friend in common, Bo Bothwell. And so he said, when I was talking about Sugarloaf, he said, well, you know, I know some people that work with that. I'm like, no, hook me up. And so he did. So welcome to the show, Melissa and James.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, so I'm going to start with you, Melissa, to talk about Black Arc, and then let James come in and talk about the mission and some of the projects of public, counter-public. And it just seems like a very forward-thinking organization. And for St. Louis, I really want to see how you all are pushing ahead with some of the parochial and I would say resistance to new ideas, new ways of thinking. So start with you, Melissa.
Sure. Yeah. Melissa Saunders. I am director of community engagement at Counterpublic and also principal at Black Arc. I'll let, of course, James explain way more about Counterpublic, but from the Black Arc side, I'm an architect here in St. Louis, a licensed architect, where Missouri only has about 8 Black women who are licensed architects in the state of Missouri. So the field is one that does not imagine spaces through the lens of Black voices and those who have been marginalized. And so my practice really focuses on designing with those people as partner, thinking about lived expertise as equally as valuable as the technical expertise. So we're always collaborating with communities and organizations that are embedded in the spaces in which we're designing for.
Tell us about one of the projects that you all have done or collaborated with.
Sure. Yeah. So we've done a lot within the neighborhood planning realm. One of the projects that we've done is the We Collab resident investment plan, which was adopted by the city of St. Louis, and it was led by the residents in Visitation Park and West End neighborhoods, and they were sort of thinking through what the future of their neighborhoods was going to look like and how they want to position themselves towards the comprehensive plan in St. Louis. And then another project we worked on was reimagining the workhouse after the workhouse was closed. Action St. Louis and Arch City Defenders closed the medium security prison, and we worked to reimagine what that space would look like in a post carceral situation.
And so that those two are interesting projects because I think people know about the closed workhouse. I know we are the Organization for Black Struggle, which I'm head of, was a part of that. It has been part of it even before Action St. Louis and Art City was even established. So it's been a long struggle
It
to
has
get
been.
that, and interesting to see what could be imagined on that space. Now, I knew about We Collab, but it's interesting. I only thought it was the West End neighborhoods. I didn't know that it was Visitation. So I'm glad to know that that's a neighborhood that's part of that because that was a stable, neighborhood for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
James, what's happening with Counter Public?
I mean, first of all, acknowledging Melissa, Director of Community Engagement, and I think like we really glean a lot of expertise from that architecture and like thinking through like the lived experience of St. Louis in that built environment. So just acknowledging that. But Counter Public itself, it's a nonprofit public art organization at core. Our main emphasis is we have a citywide exhibition every 3 years. So it was last in 2023. It will be coming up again in fall of 2026. And that's really like a moment to sort of see St. Louis kind of in collaboration and put a big spotlight on what's happening here all the time through this kind of specific event. But really at core of what we do, can mention some of that like using art to reimagine public life. And kind of behind that is really an interest. Like, I think art has always been connected to social movements and always been at core of like any vision of what a fulfilled life looks like has art in the homes, in our schools, in our parks, and that like equally a thriving St. Louis has art everywhere. And it has art equally valued in all parts of the city. And so we were interested in that question of like how to connect art and social change in a conscious way. Where does art sort of leave the gallery and leave the museum and actually connect with movements happening on the ground with longer term change? And I think what we'll be talking about today is really like at the core of that. I've been talking about it increasingly, like as Counter Public was becoming an organization, this idea and question of Sugarloaf Mound actually was happening at the same time. And it was really like, how do you create an arts organization that does create meaningful change and doesn't just talk about that or doesn't just depict that on a wall somewhere, but actually lives that out in real ways?
So, it's I think that piece of it can be very inspiring to communities. A couple of weeks ago, I had Vivian Gibson and Damian Davis talking about that project. And for Damon, who I've known since, since the Ferguson uprising days. And what art has meant to him. And when you were talking about the intentionality with art and social justice, I immediately thought about some of his comments. And even where those monuments stay and how long they stay and what they mean to people who interact with them. I mean, all of that from the artist's point of view is very intentional, and the kind of research he did with the help of Vivian Gibson was pretty amazing. And then this past Saturday was the opening of the Mill Creek exhibit, and it was standing room only. I mean, I went there specifically for the video that Vivian had done. And there was no way in the world I was going to go through that exhibit. It was just packed. I mean, I need space and time to look, read, and sometimes then I do a little little more research on my phone, so I need to go back at a different time. But my point is, there were so many people interested in Mill Creek, what had happened, the intentionality of the destruction. And I would say for communities of color, particularly Black communities, when we look at like how the decimation happens under the guise of, progress, urban renewal, yet it is our neighborhoods, our memories, our culture, our institutions that get erased. And then we're in a situation where we have a man in the White House who already thinks we should be erased, and so he's attacking our museums, attacking our culture, banning books, and all of that. So to me, it's the organizations like you all are even more important in terms of preserving and protecting the art that already exists, let alone reimagining some new ways of and thinking of things. So talk a bit about Sugarloaf. I know, I mean, people don't understand that indigenous people were here long before we were. I mean, long before we were. And so people still don't know that this used to be called Mound City. And well, once you get rid of the mounds, there's no reason to call it Mound City anymore. So if you could talk about the history of the mounds and how Sugarloaf was left, and why it was important for that to be a project of Counter Public.
Definitely. I mean, starting just with the mound history itself and kind of grounding us to where we are is, this region, because of the rivers, because of the confluence and the meeting of those rivers, has been a key place of human settlement for like millennia now. And so well before this, I think people might be familiar with the Cahokia Mounds across the river in Illinois, about half an hour drive from downtown. And that culture is the Mississippian people were a massive settlement and Cahokia, but also it was a civilization that stretched along the rivers, kind of both north and south of where we are today. And of course, we go maybe to Cahokia and you see it and you experience the mounds and think like, okay, they were just congregated here in this particular place, in the city of what was Cahokia. But as you referenced, like St. Louis, known as Mound City, is at the point of European settlement, there were upwards of 200 mounds in what present-day city of St. Louis. They tended to congregate mostly around the river and also around Forest Park, right? Like how this was imagined to be a park and like this sort of landscape, again, by settlers, it was because it was already a sort of place of gathering in a particular way. So the site of the St. Louis Art Museum, for example, believed where the parking lot is now, was a mound grouping. Throughout the park, there were other mound groupings. But so again, upwards of about 200 mounds. So through settlement, through the building of railroads, housing, highways, the World's Fair was a big flashpoint of, systematically these mounds were unprotected, taken for granted, and they were just destroyed. The most maybe like famous version of that, there was a place called Big Mound, which is on the northern riverfront, just off of Broadway, where the new, I think, usual bridge is. Like at the foot of that bridge, you can go there and see a like small stone with a plaque site signifying it. But the History Museum has these images, you can find them online very easily, of this big mound with people standing on top of it and then it being just chipped away and getting smaller, but people still standing on top of it, sometimes with shovels, just like this was like an expedition. And so you see this mound and now it was destroyed entirely, I think, by the railroad crossing the river. So fast forward that there is one kind of publicly kind of claimed, considered mound still left in St. Louis. It's called Sugarloaf Mound. It is roughly where Highway 55 and Broadway meet. So it's between Highway 55 and the River Bluff. And this mound, Sugarloaf, it's a platform mound, which just means there are three tiers. You can think of a sort of stepped structure river of Three Tier Mound. It was thought to be visible all the way to Cahokia. So it was on the river bluffs, kind of like you're entering Mississippian territory, and with signalings that you could see all the way to Cahokia. So there was communication happening in this way. It is thought to be a ceremonial mound, not a burial mound, but it's that is still being kind of researched. But this mound is considered the last intact mound in Mound City. And so fast forward from 200 to 1, and the only reason it was preserved is kind of through an accident of history. Adjacent to the mound was a quarry. So there's, I believe, a limestone quarry was right next to it. And so they were chipping away at this. So the ground was unstable. It meant that part of the mound itself was lost to this process. So it did not escape damage. But what it meant is when the construction of Highway 55 came through St. Louis, it dips around the mound because the ground was too unstable from the quarrying process. At no point was there a plan by the city of St. Louis or the federal government or the state of Missouri to protect this place. It was just preserved on
But James, did
accident.
people even understand the significance of it? Did they know what it was?
There was a known history to it. So, especially because of Big Mound, like most of the historic record talks about that mound. And like there were conversations, there were editorials of like, maybe we should preserve these. You know, if we destroy them now, they will never be remembered. There will be no document of their kind of meaning and existence. That said, like I think when there were different narratives, mostly like highly racist views of like there's no
I'm
way the
sure.
civilization was advanced enough to create these structures intentionally. They must have just been like haphazard or accidents, or they're just hills, or you know, whatever you can imagine the arguments. And but there was an awareness that the mounds were important, and they were sort of signs of a kind of very sophisticated culture. But yeah, there was never a plan, and you know, the end point of the story is, you know, maybe a positive one, but like yeah, the city never took any sort of preservation action, but neither did the federal government. The way it did. And part of that is St. Louis's history of being like really the engine of westward settlement, which equated to the forcible, violent removal of Native people from this land and many others. But because of that, I think there was like an intentional blindness of that preservation. Like Native people were forcibly displaced from St. Louis area, but still now there's no federal or state recognized tribe in Missouri. So when you're looking for those native presences, it was illegal for native people to own property in the state of Missouri and well into the 20th century. So you look around and it's kind of like it doesn't feel like there's a very visible native presence here. It's like by design. Like a lot of things I'm sure you talk about in this show week in, week out, like St. Louis has a pattern. And you know, worth noting the Walter Benjamin's book, Broken Heart of America, kind of talks about this, like the blueprint of kind of some of St. Louis's patterns around removal and displacement. Really, it starts with Native people in this region.
And I just, I've had Walter come on the show and talk about, broken and give us a little bit more history about how important Missouri was to the rest of the country in many different ways, and one of them which you just spoke of. And I just want to let the audience know that we had planned to have someone from the Osage Nation here, but they are recovering from surgery, and so we wish them well in that. And we will have this group come back on because you need to know about the progress that's going to happen, and whether or not at some point we may need some public support and maybe even public pressure to keep this project going. So I want to ask you, Melissa. James talked about the fact that it was almost serendipitous that the mound was still there when there was a construction of Highway 55, because we know from looking at all of the communities, historic communities of African Americans, it was the highway that like destroyed communities, always under the guise of, progress. And
Exactly.
so how did that feel for you to know that somehow this could have been a history of, and it'd be just a plaque like the other places,
Sure.
and instead we were able to no planning, no intention of this place still standing. What does that mean for the project going forward and for the Osage people?
It's like what we were talking about before. There are the cycles of this, and watching those cycles sort of repeat themselves throughout history, and knowing that there's such a alignment between Native histories and also Black histories that have happened in St. Louis, and how people have been removed and displaced. It's amazing that the mound wasn't taken out, and it's sort of it's kind of surprising in some ways, but great because of all of the things, the factors that kind of contributed to that. But it definitely was in peril for a long time, and it took a lot of people who were talking about the significance of the mound. I know like several people at the Landmarks Association and stuff had started to write up that history so people could understand that this thing that was sort of hidden in plain sight was still there, and still had the significance. And even though we have sort of this less visible indigenous culture, native culture in St. Louis, it still is here and still resonant and relevant to us moving forward as a city as well. So, I think as we're thinking about like the futures of this, a lot of it is visibility. A lot of it's visibility. A lot of it is making sure that people are aware of these systems that are continuing to happen in the built environment that contribute to the loss of stories, the loss of agency, the loss of histories, and how do we push back against that? And a lot of it is we have to talk about it, and we have to be able to put it on full display for everyone to be able to engage with it.
And before we can do that, talk about it, we have to know about it.
We
And
have to
so
know about it,
that's one of the
exactly.
importance of the show, because I think a
Yeah.
lot of people, like I said, that article in the St. Louis American on the reclamation just kind of went pew, like, okay, what so? And then because there's no identifiable indigenous community here, that people don't really see Native Americans. And I remember this must have been 20 years ago when I happened to talk to an indigenous person, and it was somewhere where they were filling out paper, and they were saying that oftentimes they are marked as white, and so therefore their whole history, their ethnicity, all of that gets like erased. And so that just made me more aware of what it meant to be indigenous in this region, which for a lot of people, up until maybe 30 years ago, when we started getting Southeast Asians coming in here, that it was only black and white, and nobody else, no recognizable, sizable communities existed or were considered important. And of course, black people were fighting to preserve their own communities. And so, when I think about indigenous land, and you talked about the Mississippian people and the Osage people, who else was there in this land, so that people can kind of get an idea of the vastness of it and what it's going to mean to pull all of that together in the new project, to try to like let people know what happened, who was here, why they were here, where they went, all of that. But what were some of the other nations that were here, whose land we are sitting on now and need to be honoring and respecting?
I mean, there's certainly
One of
two
you all can answer
threads.
that.
I mean, two threads to it. I think one, like historically, like the Mississippian people had sort of splintered by the moment of European settlement. But the tribes sort of occupying this land. So the Osage Nation, and of course, the Peoria, the Illini Confederacy, there are kind of many tribes that at different moments in that history were sort of overlapping, living peaceably in many cases, but in different parts of present day St. Louis, Southern Illinois, in kind of greater Missouri. So there are quite a few tribes that had occupied this land. And then equally, like, just to note is, like, there are many Native people living in St. Louis today that maybe didn't have sort of like ancestral connection to this, but there was like mid-century, there was a kind of like urban jobs program, which was really to sort of think that my understanding of it is kind of destabilized tribal like reservation structure and power and like being the minted cities, but it's kind of like an integration effort. So there are people who came to St. Louis like mid-1900s for that reason who have been here for several generations. There are many people who've moved here for school, for jobs, for any number of reasons too, who are also present. And I think part of the work, I think, to go forward for Counter Public, but also I think just task for the city is like how to sort of celebrate and honor that, like this place that Native people can return to and thrive and be visible and celebrated. Like a key place for that, it'll be again in April is the Booter Center at WashU hosts a powwow, which is a moment where people really like can come together and celebrate those connections. So I'd recommend like the Booter Center in general is a great resource for this to map the different tribes. There are online maps as well that you can look at and just see who lived in this land, like wherever you are and listening from. You can look very specifically at a map and see who lived there when, as ways to kind of acknowledge those histories too.
Yeah. And I think that's important, particularly when the whole racist narrative is everybody's an immigrant, whether they stayed here, whether they were forcibly brought here, that they don't belong. And so when you see the vast societies that existed before colonization happened, it's pretty remarkable. Now, I know that Dr. Andrea Hunter, who's with the Osage Nation Historic Preservation Office, is not in St. Louis, but were you all working with a local Osage association as you were doing this project and will continue to do it?
Yeah, I mean, Melissa, feel free to jump in here too. But the thing we were talking about the Osage, right? We keep using the word Osage Nation, and it's important to write they are a sovereign tribal nation, and who is based in Pawhuska, Oklahoma. So that's just outside of Tulsa, and that is where the Osage were forcibly removed to. That is where their tribal reservation is present day, but it's where they're most most concentrated population, but it's where their government is seated. So when we're talking about kind of collaborating with the Osage, it was governmental. We had to be invited through tribal protocol. We approached them in 2021 as the kind of initial step to just be asked permission, not even fast forwarding to everything that ended up happening there, but just to talk about it. Like we want to understand shared language. Do we have permission to speak about Sugarloaf Mound? Do we have permission to bring people to Sugarloaf Mound and to bring visibility and attention and education and all these other things? And that was, again, that was working through Dr. Hunter in the Historic Preservation Office, that went through their tribal cultural elders, who reviewed our request and ended up being kind of a collaborator in that. So there wasn't a St. Louis-based partner, so to speak. They are present and come here. There are Osage people who live in St. Louis, but this was really a kind of a partnership with the tribal government itself.
And I think that's important to note because, again, many folks who live in this country don't understand that there is still sovereign land, even though there is a ugly history of treaty signing and treaty violations. And so I'm wondering when you approached the Osage Nation Historic Preservation Office, what they thought about this. And I'm just thinking about historically when people come, they're not coming with good intentions. And so you got a whole history of, white man with forked tongue. And so were they open to it? Were they hesitant? Were they like, let's check this out, see if these people are sincere? What was the response that you all got from the Osage Nation?
Yeah, I mean, I can respond. This was before
Yeah,
Melissa
this
was
was before I
catapulted.
wasn't a part of that initial context, so
Okay, but you could
Yeah, I
probably
mean,
imagine.
Oh, yeah.
all of it. Yeah, everything that you said resonates. I think they're very cautious. They're very intentional about who they partner with. That's why, every kind of decision was vetted with them about artists that we ended up working with at the site, what that artwork was. How we talked about it, is the language aligned? Is it in service of their kind of sovereignty and self-determination? Is it in line with a kind of written preservation plan for the mound that they had already? So the process, I mean, Dr. Hunter has gone on record. I can't remember where right now, but like in a previous interview, it's just like kind of like, who are these people and like why? Why are you know also it was like it was an arts organization and we were saying like we want to work with you to like on a land back ever we want to work with you to return this land and they were kind of like hi like and
And James,
who are
don't
you
you think
and I'm
that's a legitimate question? Because
that's
when I saw
100%
what Counter Public was, I said, okay, now what does this have to do with Osage Sugarloaf?
hundred
What's the connection?
percent
But really, it was just out of deep commitment to the land and to culture that you all, were sucked into that, right?
I mean, I can talk about the steps to it. It really started, I would say, like as a neighbor, almost for me personally, right? The longer history is like I'm not from St. Louis. I came here, I've been here for more than 20 years. But the Osage purchased a portion of the mound in 2009. And I was active in the greater area near Cherokee Street at that time and remembered it. And then over time, I had different friends and collaborators. One photographer named Jen Colton and an architect named Jesse Vogler had started working at the site, kind of documenting it. So Jen has been taking photos of not just Sugarloaf, but all the mounds, both what she calls significant and insignificant mounds, is a technical definition. So I knew people who were working there, week after week. And I was kind of following it. And then they tore down the first house. So, we skipped some steps, but Sugarloaf had three houses constructed on the mound itself. So, again, I was saying three platforms, there were three houses. So, the Osage Nation, working with Landmarks Association and other community partners, purchased the first portion of the mound in 2009. I think it was 2014. They tore down the house after a kind of deep archaeological study needed to happen of like what could they do that still wouldn't damage the mound itself. So they took down the house. So I was like kind of watching this just as an informed person. I grew up in Mississippi, in which like there's a road there called the Natchez Trace, and there are mounds all along this, and they are protected sites. And so I think I was clued into this, right? Like I'm used to mounds being preserved, being acknowledged. Like there's the Mississippi Band of Choctaw that are very active there. And so there is kind of representation in that state for all of its other problems. Like that part was like a visible part of my like landscape. So I was always kind of struck by like the way in which like Sugarloaf had no signage, no mention. There was no marker whatsoever, certainly
So
no
you could
like
drive by there and not
involvement.
even know what it was, right? Not at
Definitely.
all.
Still now, I think that that is its current state as it's transitional right now. So I knew it through these stories, right? Like through their activity. And it was just always stayed on my mind. And then when we were kind of moving to like formalize Counterpublic as an organization, trying to connect art, like longer term change. For me, these two things were like totally the same. It was like I kept just like almost obsessing over like why is no one else doing anything? Like the Osage were, taking actions, and I was kind of like, why is St. Louis at large, like the population, the government, organizations, like why is no one taking more action? And as we were getting ready for our 2023 exhibition that was kind of talking about these like histories of the land and the sort of series of displacements that had happened, but also thinking about what does repair look like? What is actually like doing something in response to what we know look like. So Damon Davis's Mill Creek Valley project was part of that exhibition, actually, 23, alongside Great Rivers Greenway and City SC and Harris Stowe and many others. Sugarloaf was kind of a key of like, there is action that can be taken here. And we don't want to talk about Native history and Native futures without doing something about it. And so the opportunity of Sugarloaf was like, that's where we started with the protocol. Like we asked, can we invite artists to work in response to this site? And so we worked with Osage artist and Anita Fields and her son Nikosi, adjacent to the mound. We asked if we could activate it for education purposes. So we brought field trips and many school students like to the mound itself to talk about these histories. And then the third part is, and then long term, we want, can we work to help return this land? And so that was our proposal to them to start.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, if Voices fam, if you're just joining us now, we are here talking about the reclamation of Sugarloaf Mound, the last of the mounds in St. Louis that were belonged to part of the land of the Osage Nation. So we have Melissa Saunders here and James McAnally talking about that they were a part of that project. And I'm just thinking now, clarify for me, there were houses built on the mound. Was that by the Osage Nation that built it? Because I remember there were somebody built a house there in 1928, right on the top, and that was finally demolished in, I think, 2017. So, I mean, were people just going there building stuff? What the hell was going on? Tell me.
It's interesting. So I wasn't a part of that initial contact with Osage Nation, like I mentioned, but adjacently, so I'm from St. Louis and have been here most of my life, and I was in grad school at the time when the first house was demolished. And I was taking a historic preservation class with Andrew Weil. And so I was really understanding more about that, the mound, and then also the disrespect of how are we building buildings on something that is, sacred and important to an entire culture. And there's one left, like there's only one left. So I was being energized on that side from like the architectural standpoint. And so I think it really was like, us as neighbors, us as residents in St. Louis who care about what does it mean to have something that is important to cultures and have it be removed, and then like there's an opportunity to repair it. That's a really important thing. And so when I came on, this process was already started, but it was already like it was great to like be able to be a part of that piece of just like, how do we actually get this back into the hands of the Osage? But you're right. Yes, three homes were built on the mound, not by the Osage Nation, by individuals. And we could probably share a little bit about who those people were, but there's also an interesting tie back to even like the workhouse, where we mentioned the workhouse really early on in this process. One of the homes was built by formerly incarcerated or incarcerated folks, actually not formerly incarcerated folks from the workhouse, way back in like the 20s. So all of those things are sort
That's
of
when it
all
was a
connected.
workhouse, and you actually had to work to work your sentence off. So you
Exactly.
went
And so one
to,
of their work projects is to build, a building.
Wow, what an interesting connection.
It's crazy. I didn't figure that out until I was actually working on workhouse project and this at the same time. And then James mentioned it to me, and I was like, the ways in which the circles of the history kind of all just always come together.
So I'm thinking, well, then, Melissa, who owned the mound that people could then say, I'm gonna either purchase land to build, and with the last residents who that was demolished in 2017, was that willingly they said, okay, we understand the importance of this, and we're gonna willingly sell the back to the Osage Nation? How did they acquire the mound after these inhabitants decided that they were leaving?
Sure. James, you want to? I feel like you
I
can
can
maybe touch on
try,
it
yeah.
delicately enough.
So yeah, I'll try to synthesize some of the with modern, right? So at this point, the Osage Nations in Oklahoma, I think it was treated like the rest of the land. It was apportioned and like carved up as lots. And in the, yeah, somewhere in like the 20s to 40s, the houses were beginning to be constructed. So it was the neighborhood. Again, like Mill Creek and like many places, like before Highway 55, it was a neighborhood. There were houses all around that area before that was the quarry. So I think it was this moment, like after the quarry had sort of started to complete, like wrap up its work, then houses started to be built in that area. So it was three different houses on the mound itself. The one purchased by the Osage Nation in 2009, it came up for sale. Like the previous owner, I think, I can't remember if he died or just was electing to sell it in older age and like move elsewhere. But it came up for sale. It was listed publicly, and I think that's when Landmarks Association and Osage Nation got involved together, along with other folks, for fundraising and advocacy, and they purchased it. You know, it was not, again, an intentional process that was given to them or anyone kind of did the right thing on this, other than the people actually actively involved. And what happened after that, and this was what I kept obsessing over, is there were still two houses that were occupied for that. So the first house came down, and people were still living on this mound until summer of this year when we closed.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so one, it was a woman who grew up in the house. It was her grandparents' house. She lived there for upwards of 8 years. And it was, you know, a single family residence. And then the third house, the kind of lowest tier, it was a fraternal organization owned a house there that was basically, I mean, it was a fraternity house
A party
functionally.
house.
It was a party house. People were living there,
Yeah.
again, actively until this summer.
Wow.
So our involvement was really like to come up with a legal and or financial process to purchase or transfer those two houses. The range of options when we started was like to set up a will, because the woman who lived in the house her whole life, she was very open. She thought the right thing to do when she left would be to kind of transfer the home to the Osage Nation. But there's no like legal, there's nothing in writing. There's no like
Right.
legal actionable thing about that. So we started like, maybe we can help draft a will. With the fraternity, we had both houses appraised. We tried to buy them at or higher than appraised value. We were fortunate we received a grant to kind of fund this process that we were like seeking out. So we had financial means, like no one was getting moved. It was like the right thing to do would be to leave. We will compensate you so that you can secure other housing, essentially. And fell apart many different times and ways, but eventually what we did is the woman who lived there signed what's called an option agreement that meant it was irrevocable. When she chose to leave or when she passed away, the house would and we would compensate her or her family for leaving. So she signed this process, and that's when we made this whole thing public. And this was about a year ago now. So last November is when we signed that agreement.
Wow. So in the few minutes that we have left, I really want to talk about the future of Sugarloaf Mound, because first of all, you still are in the process of stabilizing that area, but there's also the need for the development of the interpretive center, which is what we see over at Mound City, Cahokia Mounds, and so are you all a part of the long range plan for Sugarloaf, and what is that looking like now? I know some of it is about raising money for what's supposed to happen there, what should happen there. So tell our listeners about what that looks like so that people can see how they can get in where they fit in.
Melissa, do you want to
James,
talk
I'll
about
let
the
you.
Board of Aldermen thing? But I, yeah, the brief version, is so we purchased and transferred the homes. This was just in September of this year. So that they were vacated, they're now empty, and they're fully the entirety of Sugarloaf Mound is owned by the Osage Nation. They are going through studies now, again, like how to intentionally demolish the houses without damaging the mound, which is very sensitive, as you can imagine. Like, I mean, the fraternity house has literally an in-ground pool that was dug into the mound. I mean, it's like
Wow. What?
the violence is like very direct
Yeah.
in terms of the mound. And the
Wow.
foundations, you know, there's a basement that has stone foundations. So they have to very intentionally take these apart, which will be expensive and take time. So that's the initial need, and at which point they will then like preserve and stabilize the whole mound now that they have possession of it. The long-term goal of an interpretive center, it would be adjacent to the mound. So there is still the Missouri Department of Transportation owns a lot next to this that they are still, the Osage are still seeking to purchase or control that land, and that would be the site of the interpretive center. So it's a long range plan, but like notably talking about Cahokia, Cahokia is a state site. And that means it's not self-determined by Native people. It's maybe at best in consultation with, though their history has not always been that either. So if you read through their materials, often they talk about the Mississippians, but they don't talk about the existing tribes who are d descendants. So it's a way of sort of saying this is like ancient history and then ignoring maybe the present conditions of things that could change. So it would be the first Native-led in this region, like full stop. So it is a really important kind of long-range plan. So the Osage Nation Foundation is like financially probably the way to get involved. I think that there would be other advocacy efforts too.
Okay, now you did talk earlier about there were some tours. Are those still going on so people know what the land looks like and maybe even in the head sort of start to visualize what it could look like, or when it actually gets built and developed, they will remember what it once looked like. So those tours, were they just for the purpose of getting people to know that so you could get to this next step, which is buying the land and that kind of thing? Do you
Yeah, it
see
was.
that happening in the near future?
Yeah, so at the moment there aren't regular tours or anything that take you through that site. That was a part of the exhibition in 2023, and it was primarily to, like you're saying, to apply some pressure so that we could go through that process of getting the rest of the mound rematriated. There are several historic pieces and images and things that you can look at that kind of archive that space as how it's been sort of through history up to a point. But the purpose of the interpretive center, once it gets to that point, is to be able to more in depth, like provide a more in depth experience of understanding that history outside of just our sort of how we've translated that.
Yeah.
And if
And I'll
people
just
wanted to get more
say,
information, is there a website
yeah.
exclusively for Sugarloaf?
I don't know if the chat translates to the Facebook Live or whatever, but I can drop it in the chat. And I will say
Okay.
both for references and for tours, like reach out to us anytime. So our website is counterpublic.org. I'm James at counterpublic.org. Melissa at counterpublic.org, and we are very happy to offer tours and any connections that we can. And I will add the preservation plan and where people could go on the Osage Nation's website to the chat.
Thank you both of you, Melissa and James, for not only the commitment to self-determination of the indigenous people of Osage Nation, but really modeling the behavior of what we are supposed to do in this country in terms of the inclusiveness. It's not just about a DEI office, it's actually about the work and supporting the folks who need to be supported in ways that they have asked to be supported. So that self-determining determining piece is really important, and I'm glad you raised that up, that they will be one of the first in the nation to even do that, because that was going to be one of the questions I had, was were they going to be connected to the parks and all of that stuff? Because then there's a level of bureaucracy, there's a level of control, there's all of that. So I am elated that this is going to be a self-determining project, and it'll be solely the Osage peoples, moving it forward with supportive allies like yourself. So thank you for what you do. We have that Osage culture Sugarloaf link in the chat, but we will also put it with the announcement about this show. And speaking of shows, if you missed any of them, you can go to jamalarogers.com for the audio. And we're trying to figure out a way to connect the website now with the YouTube channel for the visual, because people often like to see who's doing the talking. And I'm that way as well. But the quick and dirty way, we can quickly put it up on the website so people could hear it. And next week, we are going to have representatives from the People Not Politicians campaign, and that is the campaign that's collecting signatures to put on the ballot next November a stopping of the illegal gerrymandered map that the Missouri State Legislature gave us. And so we'll have people talking about that. But I do want to tell people, this is a caution, that we're doing so well with collecting the signatures, we now have sabotage going on. So there are people that may be calling you if you sign to say, did you know there's problems with this? And do you might want to consider taking your name off. So that is bogus. That is an attempt to derail the successful petition gathering that we've been doing so far. In the next 2 weeks, we're going to be heavy and hot out there trying to get the last of the signatures. In fact, more than what we need. But be cautioned, be warned that some people may be calling you to say, did you sign this? You might want to get your name off of that. Those are enemies of democracy. I'm just going to put it like that. Enemies of democracy. So, yeah, we want to continue to get you involved, stay involved. The Mill Creek exhibition will be going on for several weeks, months. Get in there. You got time to do that. I don't know if they're going to do the documentary piece. They did two showings on Saturday. So you may not see that, but certainly the exhibition is there for you to take a look at. And that is powerful in and of itself. So yeah, we always, this is all so inspiring. At least for me, it's inspiring to know that people are moving ahead. They're trying to preserve their history, their culture, and we need to find ways to support the Osage Nation in this project. Those of us who physically live here, we have that obligation, I do believe. So again, thank you all for coming on the show. I know this is a busy time for you all, but hey, good work. What can I say? You're doing good work. So thank you for joining us. And this is Jamala Rogers, your host. And I hope to see you on the battlefield, because we got plenty of them out there. But thank you. Be safe. And stay
well.
Thanks for being here.